Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening to the show, dear listeners. This is Wes Roberts, sitting in ever so briefly for your host, Leslie Mitchell Clark. Folks, we do apologize very much for starting the show so late. We're sure we would have lost some of you. We had some technical difficulties, but not on our end. We were unable to get through to Blog Talk Radio at all until now. Certainly, I've been trying for the last 40 minutes to call in and start our pre-taped show. We have an excellent guest, and it looks like what we'll have to do now is perhaps begin to air the show that was pre-taped yesterday, so I'm sorry you won't be able to call in, and perhaps pick up the other half of the show or maybe run it in its entirety in a week or so from now. So please stay tuned for further announcements to our Facebook page and to other social media and to emails as well. So without further ado, at this point, with only 32 minutes left, it looks like, for our show to run, I'm going to briefly introduce the show. We have the delight and the sheer pleasure of introducing on our show tonight Captain Randy Kramer, also known as Captain K. Captain Kramer, Randy Kramer, was given the authority to address the public on behalf of the command staff of the United States Marine Corps Special Section, to talk about some of the amazing things he has been through. For instance, he'll talk about being a product of soldier augmentation for Moon Shadow, a training program that starts with children and it begins at age 4. He also had a 20-year tour of duty off-world and also served for the Mars Defense Force. In August of 2013, his superior officers allowed him to consider going public with their blessing, and he began to do this in April of 2014. So here we are, a year and a half after that, and Captain Kramer, Randy, has been kind enough to share some of his insights and experiences with us. I think you'll find them incredible. So I'm going to start the show rolling now with the understanding that we'll try to get to the second half of the show or air the show again fully within a week or so from now, and we'll let you know on our Facebook page. Here we go.
To talk about. And so I love my siblings, but they don't want to talk about it, and so we're not talking about it.
Okay.
Yeah. We're not talking about it, so I don't know what's up exactly with them because they're not talking.
Oh, boy. Well, also not unusual, but I would imagine that there is some involvement there, but certainly
I'm not going to get into it, but there are some signs, you know, that were my older brother was experiencing post-traumatic stress disorder symptoms, you know, when he was like 4 and 5 years old, and was actually like fortunately got into a program that the university nearby was doing that was getting a grant to do this sort of child welfare thing. And so they were able to really like look into these children's lives individually and investigate what was happening and try and really come up with sort of full spectrum programs to assist, you know, whatever, you know, their developmental issues were. And so he actually had like a crack team of university smart people who were really trying to help him and sort his youth out. Mm-hmm. And I think just all the evidence of that, because I've read, my mom still keeps all that, has all these documents of what I've read, is that he went from being a really, really amazingly bright, squared away little child to a post-traumatic disorder acting out child overnight, sometime between, you know, about 4 and 5 years old, and that everything from that point is all symptomatic and reflective of what post-traumatic stress disorder symptoms would be. And I can sort of, what I remember coming along later into life as he was a bit older than that, and sort of seeing what was happening in his life could pretty much be demonstrative of someone who had their life really interrupted by something that they couldn't deal with.
Yeah.
So, and I love my brother to pieces, and he's, you know, he's okay as far as what, you know, he lives a decent life at the moment now, but I don't think he's dealing with whatever has happened in his childhood either, you know, whatever I think did or what actually we all know did for sure.
Yeah.
But yeah, no one's really talking about it or dealing with it, but yeah, I think there's plenty of evidence to suggest that stuff was going on. But,
yeah,
you know, love him to pieces, and when they want to talk about it, they know I'm here.
That's right, and that's all that can be done. That's all that can be done. And Randy, now I believe you said that your recalled experiences, or maybe you had partially conscious memories, I'm not sure, but they began quite early, again, a very typical scenario at around, you know, 3 or 4. What are the earliest encounters, or what was the nature of them that you are able to recall that pertain to this this entire program that you've been involved with?
Well, you know, adult reflection on that period of my life has been really interesting, because I've certainly been able to look back at it through a different lens of perception, where I think at earlier points in my life when I attempted to really sort of delve back into the memory of my youth and my childhood and try and sort out, you know, what was all going on in there, mostly all I could do was come away with more question marks than anything else, because there were just too many unanswered questions to understand what all these memories jumbled together meant. I kind of had to separate things into two categories, which were the things that I absolutely knew for sure had happened, and then all the other things that I couldn't be absolutely sure happened and maybe were just because I had a really vivid imagination. And so I, as an adult, I can look back on all of that. And when I say look back, I don't mean just, you know, sit back and ponder. I do deep, you know, meditative states to recall childhood memories and childhood experiences, to sift through all this stuff kind of on a regular basis. So it's kind of part of my diligent work to go through all this crap. I can say that the reflection looking on it through the lens of what I understand to be true now, has been very, very, very illuminating. And what I can say is that I knew from day one of any experience that I was having, whether, you know, being picked up and abducted or being visited in the middle of my room, I was completely aware that these things were happening. I was just framing them in the ways that a child's imagination could frame them, and in a way that I just never accepted as, oh, this is a really a thing that's happening here, not just something that as a child between sort of dream state that I'm having some kind of vivid imagination about. I can say now for a fact that I was well aware of what was going on, and I was well aware of what was happening, but as a young, tiny child, you know, you're talking when it was really starting to be aware of being taken out and doing training programs, it's like, yeah, about 4 years old. So 4, 5, 6, 7, these are really a young age of development to try and figure out who and what you are and what's happening in your world, to thrust something that completely foreign to your experience or what anybody or what you think anybody else and even around you is going through, and trying to process the disconnectivity of the experiences that you're remembering when you wake up in the morning, and trying to jumble them all together and separate them out and say, well, did I dream that? Or I don't know, that felt really real.
Yeah.
You know, I was breathing pretty hard and my heart was pumping pretty hard, you know, like it's, that felt really visceral. Like I was, the sweat on my brow, you know, was dripping into my eyes. I mean, there's these certain visceral things that I just don't think are the same as most dream states.
Right.
And I certainly now, as an advanced meditator and experiencer of the mind, I can say that there are really distinctive qualities of essence between dreams, visions, theta states, memories, fully immersive memories, you know, five, you know, when you're experiencing all the senses in a memory, you know, that these are really qualitatively different experiences in the mind as far as shade, texture, color, definition, and what I would say are also sort of applied laws of physics, is sort of what can happen in those states, how the sort of, you know, physical lines of objects are defined, how the sort of palette of colors that are used, as well as these sort of sounds and visual cues that represent these, I would say they're just very qualitative. It's a list of qualities that make those states just exceptionally different from one another when you've had enough of them. And so I can really say I know the difference between having a fully immersive memory experience, sensory, you know, full sensory memory experience versus, you know, oh, I dream of something or a vision of something or, you know, future vision of something, which can all, which has a certain quality to it, but it's not the same as a full sensory immersive memory experience. So I would just say that, yeah, you know, having dug through all of that and knowing the difference between all of that and looking back through it, all these childhood experiences, you know, now through the filter of understanding, yeah, I was really knew what was going on the whole time, but I didn't know how to process it into reality. So I just kind of felt that I had this, I was creative and I had an imagination, and that part of me was just living in this other kind of fantasy world, you know, a child's imagination world that I felt that I was living in. That was not that at all. It was a completely real and legitimate world. But it, to me, I just had to quantify it and qualify it that way so that I could kind of get through my normal day. And then I just otherwise didn't have any way to sit down and talk to anybody about it other than, you know, to say things like, hey, I had this dream, you know, and know that even though I was saying I had a dream that I wasn't necessarily talking about, I just had a dream, but that's how I had to frame it. And I certainly learned at a very young age that if you frame something the wrong way, grown-ups would give you that look of concern, the kind of concern that make them want to maybe go see you, have you talk to doctors. Yeah. And when concerned doctors talk to children, you get this feeling that this is not a free environment to talk freely, that you're under a kind of microscope, that you're going to get judged. And like, is this the thing that's going to put you in a home or a hospital or, you know, under further observation? Like, this isn't just a, hey, we want to know what's going on so we can know what's going on and help you. Like, there's a real serious like area of judgment on what you say and whether they're going to put you somewhere or decide that you need medication. And so I certainly understood that it was to my benefit that whenever adults gave me that concerned look, that I not talk about that thing or frame that thing or put it in a way that then they would not give me the look of concern, that they could, you know, be okay with that. And as long as they just kept saying, boy, you sure do have a vivid imagination, Randy, I could say, oh, yep, I sure do. And I could be fine with that. But it was, yeah, I was pretty, you know, I was aware of what was happening. It was just not in any way that I could put in a straight line and that I could sit down with someone and say, oh, hey, by the way, you know, I'm being taken out of my bed in the middle of the night and going to do military training. I'm not really sure what it's all about, but just thought you'd know, so you don't worry. I mean, there was no way for me to verbalize that, not to mention that as I got older and realized that when I did kind of think about it, I wanted to talk about some of these things that happened, that there was literally mechanized programming that would clamp down my vocal cords and I would literally lose the ability to make speech. And so that was something that was really bizarre and took some time to get over, because even in the early stages, sort of in my late 20s, when I really was starting to want to talk about it, and I was finding like the literal freezing of my vocal cords and inability to make words and sentences in trying to verbalize to someone. I mean, like you want to scream something at someone, you really want to say it, and you literally cannot, and it's not like you're frozen with some kind of anxiety or terror, like something is just clamping your vocal cords and you can't make speech.
Yes.
It's the most bizarre thing in the world. but I know other people who've experienced that, so
oh,
I know
yeah.
It's not me, but yeah, it's a totally bizarre and freaky thing to experience, but it's also just like getting your dog collar yanked too.
Yeah.
And in some way it's like, that's a kind of slavery that we shouldn't be okay with, when someone's getting their collar yanked like a dog, but they're a human being, because human beings don't, you know, get choke changed. That's not okay.
No kidding. And in fact, even what you're talking about can even occur in deep hypnosis, where a subject will say, they're not letting me talk about this.
Yep.
That,
yep.
I mean, I can have the person in a hypnotic coma practically,
yep.
And those suggestions, those neurological hookups are to a certain extent still operating.
They're stronger to resist than your ability to make them talk.
Yes,
That is what I learned.
They're stronger than anything benign and healing that I can do, because this stuff comes from another kind of technique and technology. I'm very convinced. And you know, Randy, I'm sure that, you know, we talked a lot about, I mentioned post-traumatic stress disorder earlier, and I'm sure that what we're dealing with here is a very specific type of post-traumatic stress disorder that is beyond anything that you will see individuals who've been to Vietnam or Afghanistan experience. It's a multi-layered, and I think some of it is time-dated. In other words, I think some memories are allowed to be expressed while others may not be. But we're really starting to look at this I wouldn't consider myself a scientist on that level, certainly, but with the real-time mapping of the brain, they're understanding what's going on with individuals who are recalling and remote viewing, and we're getting a handle on this, I really believe. Now, Randy, when you had your experiences, particularly as a little guy, and on into adolescence, were you engaging in this military program? Were you engaging with humanoids primarily? Were there hybrid beings involved, or etheric beings involved? What was going on?
The primary interaction was with other human beings and military personnel, but there were certainly the involvement of a couple of different species in my case, in the program that I was built under and trained under. So it was a cooperative program in that sense, that our military personnel, in order to do this program with a level of precision and scientific accuracy, they were going to need help from some extraterrestrial scientists who would give them a hand at this, and who I can sort of say, knowing a thing or two about them, are experts in this field, and expert at genetic mapping and engineering and time mapping people's lives and things like that. So that was a cooperative effort between our military personnel and these extraterrestrial personnel who were able to give their expertise so that we would actually not be rusty rust buckets, but, you know, smooth, streamlined machines, as it were. But it was not, we did not have a lot of contact with extraterrestrials at the young training stages at all. In fact, it was mostly preferred that we had human-on-human contact, and most of our extraterrestrial contact was very peripheral, in the sense that we would see our leaders and human leaders talking to them often at a distance, and then coming back to us and talking to us. And so we kind of knew there was a relationship, and it was a friendship, and it was friendly, because they always seemed to have these, you know, cordial, friendly interactions, but we never really got to hear what they were saying or understand what the conversations were about. So it was really just more like this peripheral understanding that, oh yeah, there are these ET guys over there, and they talk to your grown-ups, and it's kind of okay. So I think that was a bit of a slow acclimation thing, so that we would be acclimated without being overly shocked about it, because I still think that there is a certain acclimation that the human mind has to make, and it's okay that we have to make that acclimation. I think the excuse that it's too much of a shock is not an excuse. I think that we just have to get over it.
Yeah.
That's the answer is no. Even if it's shocking, we got to just get over it and get on with our lives. But understanding that there is an acclimation process, though, is totally reasonable. And understanding that people will have individual acclimation process is totally reasonable. And so I don't always try to remember to say this, but for everyone out there who knows what time it is, as far as, you know, exopolitics are concerned, at some point, your friends and family members are going to need help in understanding all of this, and they will turn to you when you're no longer the freak or the black sheep when everyone's talking about it. Then you'll be the person that can explain it to them. So just try and be good and patient explainers, and realize that a lot of people you're going to be explaining this to soon enough are going to really not just be acting like they're hearing it for the first time. They are hearing it for the first time. They have been living in little dark spaces where they haven't heard a word of this. So, you know, be patient with them, and, like, you know, just be willing to understand that they have an acclimation process too. So be patient with your friends and family when it comes to time to explain.
Yeah. Excellent thought there, Randy. Now, folks, if you're just tuning in to Contact this evening, we are speaking with Captain Randy Kramer, a.k.a. Captain K, who is speaking about his experiences in a parallel space program in the Mars Defense Force and the Lunar Defense Force. And one thing I wanted to ask you about, Randy, and now you mentioned this in a program that I listened to some time ago, and it has to do with the, you know, the dark agended grays. Like, I think there are many, many beings, and I had observed, or my colleagues and I have observed, that the instances of sort of aggressive grays conducting their, you know, genetic research or whatever the heck they've been doing, that these types of experiences have somehow really come to a halt. We really don't see this past a certain period of time.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that you talked a little bit about how you, as part of the Mars Defense Force, were able to put the kibosh on some of this activity by a military action on one of the moons that these negatively intentioned Zetas were inhabiting.
So history of the Zetas kind of goes like this. They were one of the first species to make a deal, and it just turned out within a pretty short period of time that we realized that was a bad deal. And we've been looking to try and figure out how to get out of that deal ever since. And it took a number of decades of developing our own very sophisticated space fighting force with spaceships that have powerful weaponry on them, and advanced weaponry, and advanced bombing, and advanced targeting systems, and all of the advanced technology that you need to deal with when you're fighting other spacefaring beings who have advanced technology. Who, I want to point out that sometimes people talk about, well, how do you fight beings that are thousands of years ahead? Well, sometimes they're not that far ahead, and we've made incredible leaps as well, and there really is just kind of a there's a bar, you know, and most spacefaring species hit that bar and don't really go too super past that for a really long time because they kind of got everything they need at that point. And so there's a plateau of sort of technological development when you got most of it down and your civilization can kind of thrive in that zone for a little while. So really it's there may be people who have more advanced technology than we do, but we're now up to that bar where most of the intergalactic species who want to come into our neighborhood, we have the right and the ability to tell them that we don't want them here or not. So over time, as we developed our more powerful fighting force and continued to tell them that we didn't like the contract and we had undid it and we weren't going to let them abduct people anymore and they needed to stop this and stop that, then we started, you know, saying more firmly, no, we really, really mean it. No, we really, really mean it. And then, okay, now you're not allowed here anymore and we'll shoot you down if you enter our airspace. And then it's like, okay, now you need to leave the solar system. You're evicted. And then it was like, no, we're not leaving. It's like, yeah, you are. And like, no, we're not. It's like, yeah, you are. It's like, no, we're not. And then you say, yeah, you are. And then we bombed him and made him go away. No, I understand. I mean that. Like, diplomatically, there was back and forth. You know, it wasn't just like, get out of here, and then we blew him up. It was really, you know, some time of, no, really, we mean it. We're serious. We'll push, you know, we'll fire upon you. We'll shoot you down. And, you know, a lot of these sort of, you know, stages of diplomatic and military action where, you know, you have no-fly zones and you're containing, you know, them in their base around Ganymede and saying, look, you need to leave here. We're not letting you fly out. We're not letting you get supplies in, you know. Where, you know, essentially you hold a seat, you know, like, you know, when you an old, what I used to call them, when you're seizing a castle, but I'm drawing a blank at what the word is for medieval wartime technology, but you surround it and you're basically, you starve them out, you fight them, you basically you wait them out. And so we kind of did that with a long time and saying, look, we're not letting things in, we're not letting things out, you have to go, we'll give you time to organize and go somewhere else. And they just kept saying, no, we're here, this is it. And we're like, okay, fine. And then, you know, we blew them up. So, yeah, and when I was in the EDF on the Nautilus, which is not a Mars Defense Force program, but when I was on the Nautilus, yep, we were in one of the fighter air wing units that got to blow them up. So, yeah, that was fun.
All right. Good for you, Randy. All right.
One for us. Yeah, so I want to make it perfectly clear that we may not be, you know, the toughest bunch of hombres, you know, in the galaxy, but we can totally hold our own now. And so people who, we really have a level of security and defense over what's coming in and out that we didn't have 10 years ago.
Well, that's excellent to hear. And Randy, now when you were, you know, a teenager and you'd passed through all of this this training, and I imagine they were stimulating the various genetic upgrades that you've had in various ways. Was there a point of accountability where you were asked, you know, do you want to continue, or do you want to go back to just a third density life? Did you have a choice at some point, and when did you really get on board as a full-time military unit?
That's an interesting question. I don't think anybody's ever asked me that before. The answer would be yes. You know, there certainly was a metaphysical playing field for this and for my experiences through this. And there was certainly an opportunity when, you know, I feel like I was, you know, really pulled out of my physical body into, you know, a sort of in between dimensional space, and had some kind of serious conversation about, okay, you're really serious about this? You really want to do this? Is this really what you want to do? You know, and we'll send you back. If not, then, you know, you can be done right now. And it was just kind of like, no, yeah, I'm going for it. We're a go. Let's do it. And so, yeah, no, there was a moment of where that was a choice, and I certainly made the choice to do my mission. So.
Okay, and when you actually left, I guess in the physical sense, were you being transported to Mars in a large vehicle of some a large spacecraft of some kind, and were there hundreds of cadets, if I may use that term, with you, or was it a small number?
So the ride from the Earth to the Moon was in a standard TR-3B Black Manta, Black Triangle ship that's made by Northrop. Mm-hmm. And that's a, you know, maybe like a 90-minute flight usually from Earth to the Moon. And then there was some processing period on the Moon, and then we boarded a much larger transport that I would – it was multiple levels, and we were on one level, and I would just have to guess at maybe the levels and how many people total, but I would say it was, you know, between 2,500, maybe 4,000, 5,000 max personnel that they crammed on that thing, and then used a larger sort of wormhole generator to move that ship from lunar orbit to Mars in a pretty short period of time, maybe 15, 20-minute flight or something like that altogether.
And was it equally balanced between men and women? Because thus far more male clients have been reporting this similar story to yours, Randy. But there must have been women involved as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would have to say that in my general accounting of that, trying to figure out, you know, what the breakdowns were, all the way from training as a child to training of other programs coming together as a teenager and finalized assignments as an adult, it really seemed to break down about 75-25. So about three quarters of the numbers were male and about a quarter to a third were female.
Okay, well, that makes sense. And when you were actually at some point able to fly craft, I suppose, either shuttlecraft or military incursion craft or whatever. Were there neural interfaces with this craft? Were your upgrades or your genetic preparation designed to allow you to be able to pilot sophisticated neural interface craft?
Yes and no. We sort of, I mean, there are some implants, I suppose, that facilitate that. And then we would wear, I mean, there was a helmet that I really felt like was doing most of the interfacing, to be honest, but I suppose there has to be sort of a two-way system to make sure that you're communicating with that solidly. But I'm not sure how, knowing sort of how those amplifiers, sort of psionic amplifiers work, you don't necessarily need implants inside someone's brain to make them work. You can really just have, you know, this kind of helmet or thing that connects over their head that can connect them up. But there are, from what I understand, some other vehicles that are mostly psionic interface only, and if you don't have a certain threshold of psionic ability, then you would need the implant for them. And I guess the training was really pretty broad spectrum. We were really trained to fly just about anything, and so I think it would go hand in hand that, yeah, there's some implants in there for piloting, that so we can not just fly our own ships, but we can fly a variety of other people's ships if we need to as well.
Fascinating. And when you were stationed on Mars as a Mars defense, part of the Mars defense team, now I believe that you mentioned that there were several indigenous beings to Mars that were reptoid, and there were, I think you mentioned, three major groups, possibly more. Now, during your time on Mars, did you see evidence, either archaeological or otherwise, of earlier sophisticated cultures or that may have lived on the surface of the planet before some destruction?
Oh, yeah, no question. No question at all. I would have to say one of the stranger things to ever encounter was moving across a desert plateau and seeing, you know, at a distance what seemed to be sort of a tall, narrow kind of rock outcropping. But as you got closer and closer, realizing that it was the metal frame of a structure, like basically if the girders of a building of maybe a 50 or 60 story building were still standing, but you know all the concrete and everything else had just been wasted away. So you still had probably three quarters of the corners and the sides that were still connected, and the other quarter that was mostly disconnected and disintegrated by that point. So it was at least 75% of the base was still intact and the structure was still intact, to recognize that that was a metal girdered building, you know, that was now just rusted girders barely standing. So yeah, that was pretty interesting. And there were certainly some other things that I would say, you know, were more timeless. Like you just couldn't say how old certain stone structures or structures that were made of stone or had stone, you know, exteriors or interiors that were clearly built, how long or old, you know, without having some technology. But seeing an old like frame of a skyscraper that had, you know, was just barely standing there anymore, that's pretty interesting. That was pretty telling, you know, if I can say that. That was pretty telling that something had been there a very, very long time ago that was, what we would consider a civilized city,
yes,
comparable to something that we would make or build.
Yes, that makes a lot of sense.
And hello again, folks and kind listeners. It's Wes Roberts, just coming in at the tail end of the first half hour of Captain K's pre-recorded interview. So we thank you for your patience and send out much respect to Randy Kramer, and thank him for his patience too, and apologize that we were unable to get to air the show due to technical difficulties on Blog Talk's part until 30 minutes into our time slot. So we will pick up again very soon, we're hoping within a week or so, and air the second half of the show or perhaps the whole show again. So, our thanks for listening so far, and as Leslie would say to you, remember, we are not alone. Good night.